the education system, it does not have like a governing body that says you will teach this way and you will do that and this is what's important and we're the authority and we'll solve all problems. So this is one reason why it makes a lot of sense why teachers have to be their own kind of authority on why they, in looking to solve the problems that they have in education, action research worked for them. Sean, S-C-H-O-N, 1983, called teachers reflective practitioners who became systematically involved in self-assessing their own work in school. In doing so, they automatically stepped into the role of producer of educational theory and user of that theory. The ultimate goal of this move, theoretically, was to bring theory and practice closer together. And Carson and Sumara later described action research as a living practice. Action research was criticized in the 60s because of its association with radical political activism. As a result, it suffered a decline for the time. Even now, as a practice, it's been plagued by questions concerning its rigor and the training of those undertaking it. Today, when practitioners are doing action research, if they're sure that the collection of information is systematic and that any interpretations made have a connection in some way to the truth, then much of the critique disappears. Action research has grown into a strong tradition of practice today. Many believe that action research must be collaborative and entail group work. That's why when you said the term collaborative, because these things are starting to clash. So a variety of forms of action research exist. It's been around 60 years, so a lot of different forms. All these methods that exist share a similar process but are viewed uniquely. They share a methodical, iterative approach embracing problem identification, action planning, implementation, evaluation, and reflection. Lewin, do you know Lewin or Lewin?
Ever heard that?
Lewin, like Lewis, Lewin.
Mm-hmm.
Lewin describes the process of action research as cyclical. The first step is to examine an idea, followed by fact-finding about the situation. Then an overall plan should emerge, followed by a decision that is directly related to the first step of the process. This completes one cycle in a model that has often been called a spiral of steps. After one cycle is complete, the results of that cycle inform the formation of another cycle and possibly another cycle after that. This approach to research is oriented to problem solving and has been said to parallel Dewey's conception of learning from experience. So there's a fellow by the name of Mark Smith in 1996 originally came up with this little chart. Can you kind of look at it? Sort of a spiral.
Where's Mark Smith from? Do you know?
Now that's a very good question. It didn't say where he was from. I'm sure you could search it out. One of the criticisms of this is that it's fine to have a model like this, but don't use it as a template. You know, that you don't, when you have a question, you don't have to get back, you don't have to answer that question. Your question can change and you can formulate new questions and just not to be locked in that. Mm-hmm. I have to finish the loop, then it can change.
That's interesting. You said that when, during all of these readings, it's something that I was having a problem with people talking about finding a metaphor for phenomenology and that it is a linear way of looking at it and a cyclical way of looking at it, And there's one step, two step, three steps for phenomenology. It just seems to me that it was very regimented, and to me, it's, did anybody else feel that, or do you know?
Like, well, people seem to like to be able to condense everything down to these little models, and sometimes it can be confusing and have can be problematic.
It seems to be counter to what qualitative research stands for in my mind, to break things down into steps like that and to provide a model. Just doesn't make sense to me, but anyway.
It's like trying to objectify the subjective kind of.
Yeah.
And of course, you can see where that comes from. As people are trying to develop methods, practical methods of doing qualitative research under that, the new epistemology, their only model for methods they have is still situated over in positivistic notions of theory and modeling. And it is very, very problematic. Like I said, on the radical side of things, people would reject that completely and say that those models are not helpful. And ultimately, they do reject it to a large extent. I think metaphor is a much more accepted method of conceptualizing qualitative research than is modeling. But you do find steps. And I think that, again, for a method to have credibility, it needs to be seen to be systematic.
It seems to take away from what it's trying to accomplish. At least that's what I felt when, as I was reading. Sorry to interrupt you.
I pulled this chunk up, this next chunk, right off the web from Teacher Action Research, Conceptualizing Teacher Action Research. There were just a few points on here that stuck in my mind. One that I really liked. Teacher action research can be a powerful tool. It's inherently critical and transformational. Even if no school-wide change results, the educators are changed by conducting the research, and the school is changed by the change in the education. I just really like that. There's another one. It acknowledges that teachers are activists whether we identify with that descriptor or not, and that our everyday actions and decisions play an important role in society and the lives of our students.
Now, whereas IPA and conversation analysis firmly situate themselves within the qualitative paradigm or domain, action research, of course, can be done using quantitative methods or qualitative, right? So they're not strictly, it's not a method as such. It's more a program for doing research, I guess, might be another word to use if you want to avoid method, where you could, or it's a process for doing research. And it's one that is very much rooted within intervention. So there's always some kind of thing going on that you then you do that's unusual, or you do in a way that's unusual because you're going to evaluate it in a particular way. So it's got that sort of built-in, if you like, purpose for it, as opposed to trying to analyze something to find a purpose outside of that.
Actually, action research is really big in Alberta right now in schools.
Uh-huh.
In fact, all the professional development funding from central office comes only if you can identify action research that you're going to pursue.
Okay.
So every school has they're supposed to have a project right now, like to improve literacy or to improve your grade 12 diploma mark, and then have an action research plan, and that's how PD funding. Okay.
Do they publish? Sorry.
Go ahead. Some people have. Yeah.
Oh, good.
The project our school had was how to take brain research and see how that affects learning, like if you connect that. So it was interesting.
You mean like proving it?
Well, they didn't really prove it. It was interesting because they started out and they didn't really know what to do. Like they heard of Marcia Tate and how she says that, you know, the way you teach affects how people learn. And they also, I taught on a native reserve for my last 2 years, and so the scores were quite low. And so they decided to try to connect those two, like what if they implemented some of the brain research in terms of their teaching to the in the core classes. And so they kind of got together a group of teachers, four teachers at first, and they kind of got together and read some stuff and tried some stuff. And then they got together again and kind of talked about it and decided what worked and what didn't, and just kind of grew in the school. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the year, the group was like 30 teachers or something, mm-hmm. and they were trying different projects.
What did they actually do? Do you know?
I do. Actually, I was on it for a while.
Okay.
It was, we sort of went through, to start with, they didn't really know what to do. We didn't know what to do. And so we went through her book a little bit. She has an awesome book, like if you're into that stuff, Marcia Tate is awesome.
And that's T-A-T-E?
Yep, yeah, M-A-R-C-I-A. And her book is Worksheets Don't Grow Dendrites. But it's awesome. But she believes in teaching to prior knowledge and not stuff that we've all probably heard as teachers, but she kind of has a plan, so we tried that and what worked and what didn't. And it was a really neat action research project. Because it was quantitative, because at the end, I mean, the grade 12s wrote their exams, so when we got their marks, and the quantitative was analyzing. But then qualitatively, like, we talked to the students and see if they were learning better and if they enjoyed school better. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We talked to the parent committee. It was really neat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like some of the University of Alberta is sort of going to pick up on that next year. Mm-hmm. And sort of helped fund it and stuff. So it's kind of growing.
Right. To me, it seems that it's big in education. Is it big in other areas?
No.
Mm-hmm. So it's just an education thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. It started out in
nursing, too, perhaps?
No, that would be clinical.
Because we were reading about it last term, and some of the stuff that came up, we read a couple of articles that we're looking at. It was something in the medical profession. It was considered practitioner-based research.
That's what it would be. But it would be following a clinical model of intervention. More so than this kind of educational. You would find parallels, I'm sure, you know, between them. I think that they, I mean, the development that she's outlined for Cheryl from Lewin and so on has come up from the education stream.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there is some literature from nursing too, because we came across when we were searching for stuff.
Mm.
I didn't really read it, so I don't know.
More practitioner research.
But when you search for it in the databases, you'll come up with some of it.
Yeah, and the process seemed really quite similar. Mm-hmm. I mean, aside from the fact you're in a completely different domain, but.
Probably with different objectives, but it's the same process. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Part of the study to the education.
Yeah. What I wanted to raise was where qualitative fits in this on a couple of levels. One level of this. What you said, I think is really important, is how this method of doing research was really criticized and fell into a lot of problems, and that typically is associated with the idea of teachers, who are teachers? Well, they're not researchers, they're not educated in research methods, they haven't had the right training, and they're usually women who can't do science, and aren't really good with numbers, and don't know how to do statistics, and blah, 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 right? That was there, very, very strongly felt.
I think that's still there to a certain extent, because some teachers won't buy into it. Because their point is, well, we're always reflective. I mean, teachers teach, and they think about what they taught. So how is action research different from sitting by yourself in your classroom and thinking about what you did and did, you know what I mean?
Also, it threatens the space that researchers were carved out of themselves within academic institutions, you know, that we're the authority, we're the experts. On this kind of thing. And so rather than bring theory and practice closer together, it actually had a really bad influence on keeping them well apart, because it set up that resentment then on both sides towards this. So the very thing it was aiming to do backfired. So where I see qualitative fitting in is I think it's really helped to revive action research for all kinds of reasons. First of all, if it's qualitative, for a large extent, it wasn't getting the same, it wasn't going to be subjected to the same kind of criticism from the so-called experts, okay? Because, oh, well, you're not doing statistics, oh, well, you're not doing research, then, so we won't worry about it, we won't get upset about it, you know, we won't make it seem, you know, that it's poor or that it's already unworthy. So it took that away a little bit. It made more sense to the primarily female people involved to use qualitative, because as you say, they were wanting to ask and be informed by the kinds of questions and pieces of information that they felt were more amenable to a qualitative idea of research and paradigm. And they have the feminist research backing, theory backing that was coming on board. And I think that all that came together at a time to really help strengthen it. And they had Morehouse describe that, I think, pretty well in their book, and in that introduction. You get that real sense that they're saying, you know, this is for teachers because of these reasons, and that it actually helped to address this idea that, oh gosh, I can't be a researcher because, you know, this is too easy. This is qualitative in the easy way of doing it, meaning I don't have to do statistics or learn the mathematics or learn all the language of the science model. On the contrary, though, as anyone knows who's ever done a piece of qualitative research, it's far from easy. It's not easy research, but it seems to be more intuitive. Maybe that's the word for, and so therefore people often feel I'm not doing something scientific and rigorous enough and reject it for that reason. So I think that those are really important issues that people were engaging with and grappling with, and still do to a large extent. Where I think the problem, the cracks you begin to see now in some qualitative action research is the same problems that we see over and over again, where there's not always a clear separation in the minds of the researchers about the epistemology that they're working from. And that's not their fault, because a lot of the research guidelines that they're working from, you know, don't engage them philosophically, you know, with those kinds of ideas or thinking. They want more hands-on practical things, and as we know, to do this sort of qualitative work, you really need to know both the philosophical orientation of it as well as the hands-on how to do it. So we have a problem where we're not getting good quality qualitative action research either. And of course, far be it from me to want to bring that to the fore, because you know I already feel at least it's been something that hasn't been subjected to a lot of criticism yet. But I worry about its future for that reason.
You know, another thing that we found about action research when I was involved in it is that it never really seems to end. Like you take, you know, you get on a project and you play with the ideas, you come back, you meet again, you go back with new ideas, you try again. But at some point, you know, the people who are funding it want you to be done. Yes. They want you to say, okay, what's the end product? What have you discovered? What can you show us that you've done and, you know, spent our money doing? And you know, at some point you have to kind of say, well, we haven't really gotten anything yet, so nothing's worked.
But it's not even that. You're right, that happens. Yeah. But I mean, I've had many, many times this has happened to me in my career. I've had people phone up from education authorities or from, you know, different bodies of education that educational people come together and got funding, and they say, we have collected all this stuff and now we don't know what to do with it. You know, we know what happened. They could tell me the story of what happened, but they don't know how to then take the next step. How to present the results, how to collate it, how to make something of it. And that makes sense. Of course, that's the lacking part. And there's not a lot of incentive to do that part, because if you're doing it and you're the practitioner, you've moved on, you've got the answer, been there, done that, know if it works or doesn't, move on, right? So maybe what we need to be thinking about are different ways in which the outcomes or the products of that kind of research can be put together. I'm hoping technology, you know, and would be a great way in which, a great tool eventually to help action researchers in schools in particular put together something that's going to be useful at the outcome of the research, but not taxing, because it has to fit the model of academic outcomes of research. It should be different, shouldn't they?
That's a great point, because I know in Alberta, with every school having a different plan for this action research stuff. I'm sure there's tons of interesting projects, you know, in different parts of the province that nobody else ever gets to see or benefit from.
Exactly.
You know, even our project with the brain research, we thought it was really valuable. And they've got some great stuff going on this year too. But, you know, how do we get to share it? How do we get to tell other people about it so that they can benefit? They don't have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, if they're struggling with the same problem, maybe our stuff would help, but how do you do that, you know, if that's true?
The Journal of Action Research in Alberta.
You know, and maybe a journal is not the right form, though. That's what I'm thinking. You know, maybe it has to be something that's not the fitting in the traditional academic method. And this is the thing that happened in my career, too. When I was at Keele, and I really wanted to be the person who could help bridge the gap between, you know, what I did. My research wouldn't just sit on the shelf and or just be stuck in a journal and know, but have real practical implications and get it out to the teachers. And I used to do a lot of professional development in the UK. And what was problematic is that I was, none of it would count towards my career as an academic. So if I was out, you know, giving my time and producing all these materials to go and give a full day workshop to present, you know, to the teacher or something, I might get paid by the local authority to make money out of it, but no credit. You know, who's going to help me become an associate, get my tenure or whatever, you know, you have to do here. So there's no incentive on this side either, on the academic side, to take a real interest and help. Mm-hmm. And so both sides need to, I think, have incentives that are going to be complementary to each other.
Are you familiar with design-based research?
No.
Okay, it's similar to action research. It's in mostly in the learning sciences or in technology,
okay.
And it's very similar, but it's more rigorous, I'd say. It also involves qualitative and quantitative methods. It's a process as well, and it's problem-based. It's very much like action research, but it's just a new developing process in our field, and it involves discovering a problem. In how something's learned, coming up with a design usually involving technology
mm-hmm.
that is posited to somehow alleviate this problem, and then working with a teacher, collaborator, and a researcher,
mm-hmm.
you design something using this technology, and then it's iterative in the same way. You take it into a classroom, you launch it, you go through it, you bring it back, you go, okay, what have we learned?
Mm-hmm.
But the difference is there's also a very particular research question about learning. So it's interesting that it's kind of along the same sort of, but it is,
mm-hmm.
of course, mostly with technology, because that's the whole point. It's a way of kind of finding a way to put technology in.
To solve a particular problem. That's great. I mean, you can see, you know, a pattern emerging that there are ways in which these things could contribute and help each other. Just hasn't necessarily happened. People are still trying to carve out their own niches.
So it seems to me that people could be doing things in Alberta and BC too.
Yeah.
And Ontario. And
oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm still in Alabama. But how would we even know?
Exactly. But the technology is going to help
localize.
People to know.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be a great problem
mm-hmm.
to pose in design-based research for technology. You know, how. What kind of forum would be appropriate for sharing of this kind of information that would then get us recognized status so it would count as an outcome and would be enough for funders or, you know, would have, so it needs to have that kind of credibility, you know, that funders would say, oh, you're going to produce this, you're going to contribute to this by the end of your research, you know,
mm-hmm.
that would take the place of this, you're going to get a journal article or you're going to, a conference or have a peer refereed something.
It seems to have a different sort of status in the UK, because in my literature view I looked at a whole bunch of different, a battery basically of action research inquiries out of the UK that were government funded and with a variety of different, I guess a coalition of different universities where they would have a mentor
yeah.
and they would come together and then it was actually published online, and so all of these over a period of 5 years government funded
yeah.
and so there's this and they're actually published so you can actually read all of them.
It's it's a smaller country but and it's all federally controlled. There's a national curriculum
mm-hmm.
national funding. It's much easier to set up those kinds of networks. And it's all, and it's very, very much encouraged, as you say.
The national curriculum for the whole country?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. provincial?
Both. Well, England and Wales have one, and Scotland has another, but they're very similar.
I think the code went down to the week, too. It's very, very detailed.
Mm-hmm. 5 to 14. Mm-hmm. And it includes things like all children from 5 to 14 have to take music.
Mm-hmm.
And have to meet certain standards. So things like that are, you know, just unheard of nowadays, mm-hmm. where music would at best be extracurricular if it exists at all.
Mm-hmm. Why does it just go up to 14? Is that the end of the compulsory?
Yes, that's the end of compulsory education. Yeah. After that, they would go on to what's called A-levels, which would have been like a grade 13 was here, but it's 2 years, so it's like a 12-13 combined. It's called sixth form college. So they often leave high school and they'll go to college for those 2 years to do their A-levels as a bridging before university. Yeah, it's got all systems, you know. It's got good things and lots of good things, but some things about it I like a lot. I like that bridging system. I think they mature and learn a lot in college before they come to university. I think we benefit from that. Speaking as someone who teaches in graduate system. Anyway. Good. I like that. That was great. Just motivated, want to go do action research. Or at least I could just see how exciting it would be if that kind of project could be taken up in at certain levels with the institution and the school.
Mm-hmm.
When it works really well and it's so fulfilling.
We had to do, when I was at Teachers College at OISE, we had to do a mini action research project, and it was, well, probably the only valuable thing that came out of it. But it was tremendous, you know, identifying a problem or identifying something that needed to be remediated or fixed. Or it was great.
It was very rewarding.
It was really, really interesting and rewarding.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really fits in with that whole notion, too, about, you know, giving back to the participants who are actually involved in the research, you know, that they're learning and getting benefiting from it, even just by having been in it at all. They benefit. Okay, good. Next. Thank you, Cheryl.
Really?